The Ridge Runner squatted by his little fire, for there was nothing dry to sit on, and he held skewers of meat over the fire and twisted them slowly, his mouth watering. The moon was on its way down for morning. Four gnarled twigs soaked in a puddle extended from his hand like arthritic fingers, and at the tip of each a barbecued mouse. Tails and feet cindered away, heads mere nubs, but a mouthful of meat at the center, and it smelled good. How many days had he paused here under this rock overhang, watching the valley, unable to bring himself to descend farther and follow the river? Once he gathered his courage and went down, he might hunt or get some supplies, ask around, ask about Mary. She must be down there somewhere, probably with the Indians, or farther on in the little mining town. He sighed deeply and closed his eyes. The warmth seemed like a miracle to him. The drizzling rain, a consolation. If he could find a dry spot, a crag or an overhang, he might even be able to sleep. For days he had been watching. There would be nothing for hours, just forest, the river, cloud. Once or twice he could spot a pale body moving by the river, Indians bathing and splashing, so tiny as to be almost imaginary. And then a train would come along the valley floor, its long wail both vulgar and cheery, a sign of life. What was the town like? How big was it? There might be fences, roads, there might be signs, simple wood planks announcing a name, property. He might find himself trespassing there to reaches of some private habitation. And always, on farms, there is an affronted figure in the distance watching. And of course, in any town, a poor stranger like himself could not loiter on the grocer's steps as others did. An outsider must keep moving, appear harmless and temporary. Curious eyes might follow him as he made his way past. Even in the bars, among drunks, there was no standing here or there, for this was someone else's plot of floorboards. There's the owner's hat, his drink, the invisible, ineffable stain of tenure that develops over time and use and selfishness and belligerence. William Moreland's hands sweated, and he wiped them on his thighs. This was where he was about to go. This was the pit into which he must crawl in order to find her. He could not bring himself to consider the possibility that she might rebuff him. Neither could he backtrack and leave. There was only one way to go. Down.
On 702 ABC Sydney, a passage from the book The Outlander by Jill Adamson, who joins us on this Sunday morning. And the Ridge Runner, just one of many complex characters in the book, but they all seem to be in their own way just walking to the beat of a different drum to society.
They're all very strange characters. It wasn't until I finished the book I realized the sheer surfeit of strange characters I had in the book. That's why I thought the title, The Outlander, seemed to be pretty appropriate, not just for the main character, but for almost all of them.
Now, you said when you finished the book, is it true that you sort of wrote the last line 10 years after you started?
I did. I don't know how common that is, but I did. I wrote it sequentially. I sat down every night and wrote a little bit. And 10 years in the making makes me sound like the slowpoke from hell, but I did manage to finish a couple of other projects in the interim. I stopped writing The Outlander for periods of time. I stopped writing at all for a couple of years, just because I felt like it. So, you know, but there was this project always in the background. So I did. I started with the first line and ended with the last line. And then I knew I was done. It was a funny thing.
Did the ideas of the novel change significantly because it took 10 years?
Well, it's a funny thing because I actually didn't know. This is an admission for a writer, that I didn't know where it was going to go at any given time. I was essentially telling myself a story, almost like telling yourself a bedtime story, and I would sit down at night and start to write and say, where are we going next? So while any writer has a sense of how to tell a story and how to sort of form a plot, I didn't know what was going to happen to Mary next. So there was a certain amount of casting about, and in that way, you know, I wouldn't recommend it as a way to write every book because it is slow.
It's the story of a woman fleeing a situation and she finds herself in the wilds of the West.
That's right, in the Rocky Mountains. Mm. And she's done something pretty bad. We find out at the beginning of the novel that she is a widow, only because she has killed her husband, or as I say in the book, she's widowed by her own hand. And it's the work of the book to figure out not only where she comes from, who she is, what's wrong with her, because there's things wrong with her. She's actually quite barking mad, but also to figure out why she might have done such a thing. And by the end of the book, I'm hoping that there's a certain amount of moral tension that is retained throughout the book, and that people come out the other end thinking perhaps a bit differently about Mary.
Is it schizophrenia? Because she does experience the voices. She experiences hallucinogenic
this
situation.
This is a very interesting thing. She actually is suffering, and I don't want to get too, you know, medical and clinical, because it's not necessarily a part of the book, but she is suffering from postpartum. And in its worst form, you'll find this interesting, in its worst form, it's called postpartum psychosis. You can have visual and auditory hallucination. You have weird ideation. You believe in very, very strange things at a time when you're supposed to be just as happy as anything and a wonderful hostess and very pleased with life. A lot of women can suffer quite a bit. And for a writer, that's a fascinating, the idea of a very profound mental illness that is nonetheless temporary is very interesting. Postpartum, like many depressions, just passes. And postpartum psychosis does too. So for me, that was very fertile ground.
It's interesting because she has no skills in the wild. She really has very few skills amongst people as well. And yet, ultimately, it's a story of amazing survival.
For me, it was important that she be absolutely lost. And lost in the woods, lost in her life, not knowing really anything about survival. It was necessary in terms of plot to have people come in at intervals and to keep her from really getting into trouble, which is what essentially makes it a picaresque. There's been sort of discussion what kind of novel it is, and it seems to be many different genres. But that's an element of the picaresque in there, that these characters coming in and through her life and then disappearing and coming in and disappearing. For me, it was important to have this character start off utterly helpless, and eventually, by the end of the book, be standing on her own 2 feet, a very capable person.
Reading it, there are two very big challenges you throw down to the reader. One is we don't know her as Mary Bolton very often. She's the widow, so we don't get to engage with a name. Secondly, there's masses of passages where there is no dialogue, external dialogue.
Yes, that's right. Part of that is the nature of I think any book, when a writer sets out on a project, it will have its own logic and DNA. And the trick for me was to lean as heavily as I could on the language, to make the language as rich as I possibly could. And many of the writers that I admire are very light on dialogue anyway, and very focused on the language. And just from a point of view of a first-time novelist, I wanted to try to get the language under control and do my best.
It's interesting also because there's almost a surreal edge to the whole of the story and the characters.
Yes.
Surrealism, is that something you indulge
well
in?
That's an astute question, because I'm also a poet, and there are a number of poets I really enjoy reading, and a number of poets that I hang out with in Canada and Toronto, and a lot of us are influenced by the surrealist poets, not necessarily by surrealism itself, but by surrealist method, which is accessing the subconscious and the unconscious and literally just creating something out of nothing without thinking first. So there's a sense of surrealism to that. And there is something eerie about that element of being rudderless, accessing the darker parts of the human psyche.
I read once where you and your partner, Kevin Connolly, he's a
That's
poet,
right.
would spend much time either in Utah or the Texas.
Which sounds horrible, but it's basically Mexico. Might as well be Mexico. It's right down by the Rio Grande. It's an enormous wilderness area. It's a national park.
So you would immerse yourself in the very same areas that the style that the widow
yes.
would do.
That's right. That's right. I actually lived in a place called Banff in Canada, in Alberta, which is about 200 kilometers north of the actual town of Frank actually exists. And the landslide actually happened. There was a massive landslide there. And it's just one of the many insults in Mary's life is that she ends up in Frank. And so I have a kind of a physical sense of what that area is like. But these other places that we go down into the States, these are desert areas, and they are virtually, I mean, there's no people. You get a nice sense of what it's like to be completely alone.
You mentioned those parallels with the Canadian and the town of Frank, but also the parallels with characters such as Angus Lorne Bonnycastle goes yes. back to your own family.
Yes, you know, naming is a funny thing. I was in the Melbourne Writers Festival and various people on stage, one woman on stage was talking about how common it is for writers to have baby naming books because we have to come up with names for characters and you get quite picky about what someone is going to be called. And, you know, I'm bad at names, so they either all end up being called Jane or David, whatever comes to mind. And so when I was trying to name people in this book, they couldn't have normal names because nobody was actually very normal. And my own family, we've got an awful lot of strange names in my family. So
that was Angus Lorne Bonneville.
Angus Lorne Bonnycastle was my great-grandfather, and he was a very sweet I never met him, obviously, but a very sweet person. And so the name attached itself well to that character because the character is very generous and very benign.
Well, if you look at the book of babies' names being the assistant to the author, I'm struggling to find out how horses, hitches and rocky trails could help you as well.
It's funny when you're doing research. Somebody asked me after I was almost finished the book, you know, are you doing a lot of research? And I said, no, I don't know how to do research. And then I looked at my bookshelf and I saw all these insane books I had piled up on, as you say, Horses, Hitches, and Rocky Trails. Fascinating book, actually, for someone crazy like me. Books on how to tie knots and books on how to survive in the wild, what to eat, what not to eat, that kind of thing. So I guess I did a lot of idiosyncratic research.
10 years in the making. It's got a very filmic quality. Is that around the corner as well? One would imagine the rights have been sold, surely.
No, not yet.
Out of here.
No. Well,
where's my checkbook?
It would be very, very nice to see this made into a movie. The only challenge would be, how do you find a main character that's that young? Mm. You need a female actor who actually reads as very young. The challenge for me throughout, as you say, the character's name is the widow, and she's called the widow throughout. It's important that she's very, very young, a person who doesn't know much about life, and yet the name the widow suggests an older woman. So there was a tension for me throughout the book to keep saying this is a girl, mm. a young person.
You've reminded me. I actually thought she was a much older woman.
And that's part of the nature of the thing, is that she is out of her depth. The young person thrown into a life she has had no hope of figuring out yet.
On 702 ABC Sydney, we've got Jill Adamson in the studio. The book is called The Outlander. I'm thinking if you were casting for the film, and I've just blanked on who plays Mulder in The X-Files, but he'd be a good Ridge Runner, wouldn't he?
He would actually make a good Ridge Runner, yeah. I think he would. I'm trying to think of...
Because you're not adverse to The X-Files.
Well, now this was years ago. I was a willing viewer of that show. I thought it was tons of fun. I thought it was creepy. And
you wrote a book on The X-Files.
Well, now, you know, this is my own stupidity. There's a publisher in Toronto that does fan books and TV books and things like this, and this is how they keep themselves afloat. They also publish my poetry, and this is how they keep their poetry line going. Well, virtually all of the good writers in Toronto have cranked out a commission book on some crappy TV show. And, you know, when I sat down with my sister-in-law, we went to a party, and the publisher said, "You like The X-Files, don't you?" I went, "Oh, yeah, it's a great, great show. Would you like to write a book? It's worth $3,000. And I said, "Yes, for
straight
sure.
away. Yeah. Let me think about that. Yes."
Yes. And then unlike my friends, I just couldn't think of a pseudonym for myself. So I used my own name. But most of them have picked names like Dallas Williams and Nikki Stafford. And that's not their names at all. So I was stupid and kept my name on the book. But I did enjoy the show, I have to say.
10 years for one novel. Do we have to wait that long for number two?
Oh, please, God, no. No, I will endeavor to move a little. You know, my pace was sort of glacial for that book. I think I know a bit more now about how to write a novel. I was not only dealing with a very thick, rich language, I was also dealing with a plot I hadn't quite figured out yet, and I was figuring out how to write a novel. Mm. And so hopefully the second time through, it may be a little easier. I don't know. Maybe it'll be harder, but...
I look forward to getting another advanced copy of that one. Jill Adamson, the book is called The Outlander. It's out now, and thank you very much for joining us on The Weekend Show.
Thank you for having me.